Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders and investors that are shaping the face of the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself called PocDoc. PocDoc is revolutionizing access to vital healthy heart screening. If you are interested in any more information, head to pocdoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. You can find all the information about the work that we're doing with the NHS to in effect deliver the NHS health check at home or the equivalent thereof. And we'd love to hear from you if you're interested in participating in what we're doing. Also, thank you very much to PocDoc for supporting the show. As ever, at the beginning of the show, thank you to everybody who's listening live on UK Health Radio. We love the UK Health Radio platform and the fact that we can reach all across the world through UK Health Radio. So thank you very much for turning up to our show, and our listener base is growing. So we love you guys. Thank you so much. Thank you also if you're listening on demand on any of the podcast channels or watching on YouTube, or even watching on Instagram. So it's at Health Tech Hour on any of those platforms, or on Instagram, you can follow me, which is at Steve Roost. And we slice up the show into the best bits and clips and put them out on those platforms. So again, thank you very much for tuning in. If you listened to the show last week, you will have known that it was a really unique opportunity that I was honored to take part in, which was an NHS menopause special with Bucky Ayoade, who's an NHS menopause lead, and Linda Barker, who is a TV presenter and menopause campaigner. The response we had to that show was absolutely incredible, both from women and from men across all the platforms. It really seemed to have touched, not a nerve, because it was a positive thing, struck a chord, I think you say, around some of the themes and the importance of communication and the importance of social media, but the risks around social media. There was a big debate about HRT, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. So it was a wonderful show. So if you're interested, check it out. It's episode 105 on the podcast channels. Let me know what you think. We're actually continuing the discussion today around women's health with my guest, Amber Fodagle, who is one of Europe's leading voices on digital technology and women's health. Amber was the founder of the Pregnancy Plus app, which became the number one pregnancy app globally, I think, or maybe in, but certainly in a ton of countries. And then was the number one pregnancy app on the App Store and the Play Store, and then was sold to Philips in 2017. Amber's since been involved in all kinds of other businesses as an advisor and supporter and all kinds of different things. And has now embarked on her new venture, and she's building an app that's focused on menstrual health education, which is an AI-powered, free-to-use, a safe platform with high levels of privacy that aims to revolutionize health, especially for the most vulnerable women. And it's called 28X. And it turns out also that Amber and I have loads of people in common, and it's brilliant to get her on the show. So Amber, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Steve. I'm very good. Thank you for having me and having the opportunity to talk about my journey.
Yeah, let's get into it. So it's quite the journey, right? So as someone who has also started a company with their spouse, you founded your business with your spouse back in 2012, I believe. And it would be great just to start off. I know you've told this story 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways. So I don't want to kind of ask you to do it all over again. But quickly, just, how did you come to start the business, and what was the big so what for you about doing it? What was the big reason why? Because you could have not done it very easily.
Oh, well, it's never the first business where you get it right. It might be very rarely. So the business that in the end became indeed the largest pregnancy app worldwide, wasn't the first pregnancy app I did.
All right.
Back in 2008, I set up after the App Store was launched, and I had a look in the store and I thought that's going to be super exciting. There was only a handful of apps. And I had a friend at the time that I worked with, and she said, "Why don't we do an app?" And I said, "It's a great idea. Let me have a look." And I had no idea what to do. So we contemplated diet apps and et cetera. Seems very complicated at the time. And then I found a list online that said what were the most profitable desktop widgets. Well, you need to be quite old to know what a desktop widget is, but in the old days, you had little widgets on your desktop saying what the weather was going to be, a few games. And they had a list of the most profitable ones. And the number seven was a pregnancy app, a pregnancy widget. And I thought, that's really weird. Why is that ranking so high? And then I thought, okay, all these women, of course, have a life-changing experience and they don't mind spending a few dollars, whatever, on a widget. So I thought, let's go into pregnancy because it's not that super competitive like games were in the App Store. My sister's a gynecologist, so I thought that would be a great app. So we built our first app. It was reasonably successful. I still had a job. Then rule number one is never work with friends, so it didn't work out. So then I started a second business, and that was very early on in the beginning. Apps were different back then. You didn't have a back end. It was all a bit more scrambled together. So I read a book, and then I thought, let's do it better. So then I set up a third company, and that was in the end Health and Parenting, to Pregnancy Plus. But by then I had quite a few failures and learnings from the first two apps. So when I set up the third one, I could use all these learnings to get it right from the start.
But why, what was the thing during those failures that like kept you going? Because you stayed, because what you see sometimes with entrepreneurs is like they try one idea, it didn't work, they pick another idea that might be completely different, and so on until they find something. But you stayed quite within your path, right?
Well, they did work. I just didn't have the right people on board. And I didn't have the right setup. I didn't know how to scale. I got a lot of the App Store optimization incorrect in the beginning. So I thought at some point it's better to start over again because with apps you have a lot of legacy, in technical legacy. So
What do you
the
mean
third one, that
technically?
was one of the names, one of the things I learned, for example, was that in the App Store, it's really hard to rank high. So if you want a successful app in the top five, you need at least 5,000 to 12,000 downloads a day, especially in the US. Well, if you pay $1.20 per install, that leads to whatever, 15 million easily in budgets for marketing. We didn't have those budgets. I didn't have any budget. I had 5,000 to spend in the beginning. That was my budget to start with. So I needed to do something clever. And from the first two apps, I learned that if you do something clever with the name, you get a hard match on the keyword. So you can't call your app pregnancy. That's not allowed. That space was taken. But my previous app was called Pregnancy and had a smiley in it because we donated to the organization Smiles, who fixed cleft palates. And I noticed that the algorithm didn't pick up on the symbol. So in this app, we created pregnancy with a space and then the plus. But the algorithm didn't see the plus. So
Oh,
we had
nice.
a hard keyword match on pregnancy. So from the day we launched, we would rank incredibly high in the app stores without any marketing spend,
But
just by looking at the algorithms.
and no one had figured this out, or no one cared enough in the pregnancy category to do something similar before.
I think people were moving over their brands from websites. So they used their website name and created apps, whereas we started from scratch and it was my third company, so I could start from scratch. And even the company name was called Health and Parenting. which were two keywords that I needed. So it wasn't a cool name for a company. If it was a cool name, you would call it The Bump or whatever, The Nest. We were called Health and Parenting Limited, which was a very boring name, but I had keyword pregnancy, health and parenting, which did the job for to rank high in the stores, which allowed us to have that freedom that you are bootstrapped, which means no VC funding.
Did you do that deliberately because you wanted to bootstrap it? And like, how much of that was like learned through the first, like how much of it was like planned versus happy accident versus like, you know.
To be honest, I don't think I knew what venture capital was. I had no idea that you could pick that up. Later, it became obvious to me what an advantage it was for not having it, because you have much more freedom ethically what you want to do with your users. But I did it old school. We made some money, and then I thought, okay, I made 5,000. Let's put it back in the company, and then we made some more money, and then we made 10K a month, and then we put it back in, and the next month we made 20K. So we constantly reinvested the money we earned.
And what was like the pregnancy's kind of a big area. So what was the purpose of the app? Like what made it different to what else was available for pregnant
I
women?
think the honesty of the app, we didn't have any ads. So our competitors, What to Expect and Baby Center, they were loaded with advertising. And I always felt that that wasn't a nice user experience. So I imagined myself as a user, and I thought that's not. And also, I didn't always agree with all the stuff that was being sold. I felt women were exploited while they were pregnant. So what we did is we had the first 3 months were completely free, because I also felt if you had a miscarriage, it's not nice if you had an app subscription. So the first ones were completely free, and then we just gave them the best experience possible. And then after that 3 months, we said there's an upgrade now for the rest of the 6 months. And people were so happy with the first 3 months that they would just upgrade. And
What
that
was your
made.
what were your metrics like on the upgrade? Like, what was the conversion rate to the upgrade from the free to the
Oh,
premium?
that
You don't.
varies by country, very much. So in Switzerland, you've got 35% from installed to paid, whereas in Brazil, it's 3%. So it depends on the country.
Interesting. But still 35% is massive. I mean, still
In some
3%
countries,
right?
yeah, but I think because if you leave, I think with all companies, if you deliver a good product, an honest product, people feel it. In the end, they happily contribute. But we also made sure there was enough content for those that could not afford the upgrade. So all the content, for example, that was free. So there were just certain features that we asked for an upgrade. And all the way to Philips, I think we only asked for a one-off purchase. It wasn't even a subscription. It was a one-off payment for $4.99. So it was the price of a coffee.
I think and how did that compare to what other people were charging?
I think
The
they
worst
went,
price.
it was similar, but they went, of course, they had a lot of advertising in there, and they would ask for subscriptions, monthly subscriptions. But it was for us, it wasn't always about the money. I just wanted to become the biggest pregnancy app worldwide,
That was your sole stated aim. That
and
was all you
deliver a
wanted to
great
do.
experience. Well, ultimately, I read, especially in the first few years, I read every single customer service ticket. And that got out of hand because in the end we had 80,000 customer service tickets a year. But I would still read loads of them. And I think my passion was, I just, if someone wrote an email saying that they felt unhappy about an article or they had an issue and that wasn't dealt with in the app, I felt personally almost responsible to fix that. And I think that passion is what people feel. You know when a product is a good product and when it's honest.
I mean, I think that there's a massive difference between it being completely faceless and the founder, you know, reading the tickets and trying to put that into the experience of it. And how like important do you think that your connection to the content was? Like, for example, could you have ever done an app where you wanted to be the number one, I don't know, baseball news app, right? Or was it because you felt extremely passionate about that particular area, pregnancy?
I think I was always very close to women's health, but I think that topic is quite broad. And in the end, I like educating large audiences because I think that's where the difference is. We have today 2 million women a day on the app. on Pregnancy Plus. 70%, 70 of first-time moms in the UK use Pregnancy Plus, and I think it's 80% in Holland, and in Germany it's 70%, and we're 40% in America.
Yeah.
But if you say to 2 million women a day, don't drink any alcohol when you're pregnant, that's a lot more healthy babies and healthy mums.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious. So, but the problem is, I think that a lot of, especially the vulnerable in our society, with lower literacy levels, for example, they don't go to the NHS for information. They go to TikTok or they go wherever they go.
Yeah.
So, but it has to be engaging. So what we did was build an engaging experience. So we had lots of articles in there that were just fun, like, what if my mother-in-law doesn't like my baby name? Or can I still paint my name, my nails when I'm pregnant? Or can I have a tattoo? Or
Okay.
what is the line on my belly, the
Right.
dark line that appears?
Yeah.
They like reading those articles, but then every eight articles, a serious one about gestational diabetes, about preeclampsia, about pregnancy, the depression during pregnancy. So if you are able to educate large groups of people about very serious topics on a very high level, that the influence is amazing, and that's what drove me. And I think because I think creating new life is such a massive life event,
Yeah.
and more healthy babies is just such a rewarding thing
Well, I mean,
to
some of the statistics. I mean, I've done a couple of shows. What one was that springs to mind with there were two representatives from a campaign group called the Black Mums Matter, and it was about the massive discrepancy in both maternal and child health statistics between white women and non-white women, even within the NHS. And I was completely shocked about that, about the health outcomes, just the statistics of them. And you know, there's lots of different reasons for them, but some of them relate to back to what you say about education, access to information, you know, access to healthcare, and all of those type of things. But I was completely shocked about that discrepancy when I heard it.
Yeah, and I think we don't realize how little education there is for a lot of women worldwide, and also here in the UK. Basic menstrual information, basic hygiene information, but also when you're pregnant, is often not there. In the US, the average age of a pregnancy, I think, in most states is 23 years old. These women are
That's the
very
average.
young.
Wow. That's
Not
quite
in some of those states, and I think not everyone's educated, and giving them a fun experience in an interesting environment that they come back to a few times a week, where they get that information that is clinically validated but packaged nicely is such a great tool. And I think that's we need to avoid people finding information on social media channels like TikTok that is not clinically
Yeah.
validated but entertaining.
Yeah. So on that, so when you were doing your app, when you were like hardcore running it, how far was the social media kind of bandwagon? How advanced was that? Because obviously when back in 2008, when you did your first one, it was mostly Facebook, I guess,
Yeah,
right?
Facebook.
Yeah. And then when you like how much of the kind of short form video stuff or the kind of attention economy was
Oh, a
coming
lot
into
less. So
play.
the problem is bigger now than it was then. But still, there you had a lot of websites that didn't have any clinical validation of the content that was written.
Right. But did you have to kind of include like short form content and stuff like that, like videos in the app? Or is that really like a
That
later
came
thing that,
later. That came
right?
later. So in the current version, you have all these nice videos, but in those days, we didn't have them in the app. It was mainly beautiful 3D models of the baby and how the baby grows, and it was 3D engines and articles and we did write the content for different reading levels.
I think it's really interesting though, because so I was at one of these events just because of doing the show. Like I sometimes get invited to events about being someone that runs a platform, you know, media platform type thing. And they were sort of pushing TikTok and TikTokers as a sort of source of health information. And it was sort of and on YouTube were there as well. And they were
YouTube
saying
Health is great. Yeah.
YouTube Health is great, but it was sort of it came down a little bit to like, well, the algorithm is the algorithm. So, you know, we try and sort of put some controls in place, but the people will choose what they want to see, and then that stuff's going to get ranked higher. It's like, I don't know if that's quite the solution, you know? Like, people are going to watch what they think is entertaining. And in health, some of that stuff might not, the messages you get across might not actually be entertaining, but they might be really important.
Exactly.
I think it's a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a,
it's a big question. The question is everywhere at the moment. Like, where do you get your education from? And especially for the younger generation is a question, because they don't go to the NHS to read about pregnancy there. It's just too dry. And the NHS, on the other hand, they can't write engaging content with fun articles, because the taxpayer will say, where does our money go to these nonsense articles about, can I paint my nails during pregnancy? They have those questions. So you do need to answer them. And I think, therefore, those apps have a tremendous role in educating women globally as well.
Yeah. So the that's what Buki Ayoade and Linda Barker said on the last show about menopause. And they said, well, Buki, who's the NHS menopause specialist, I asked her about social media, because there'd been a few days before, there'd been a big expose on Panorama about menopause clinics and how through social media women were being taken advantage of and all this kind of other things. And she said, look, in her opinion, raising awareness of menopause, perimenopause, the issues that women face, increasing access to vital information is really important, and so that social media has a huge role to play in that. But policing the kind of bonkers nonsense slash really dangerous stuff is almost as important, and that's really, really hard.
Yeah, I think when it's especially when it's tied in with commercialization. So I think women are exploited. As soon as you say menopause, people say, oh, I've got some vitamins and some minerals for you, and here's menopause clothing, and here's a tracker and an aura ring or whatever. I think the basic information is what women really need. They don't need to be sold something straight away. But that's, unfortunately, a lot of people try to make a lot of money of women where that's not always needed.
Well, after the break, we're going to stop for our first commercial break now, and then we can come back and talk about your new venture, 28X, which seeks to change that and address some of those issues by making this information free and available to all women, particularly vulnerable women or women from vulnerable communities. And I'd love to hear about it. And we'll do that right after this break.
Thanks, Steve.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Amber Fodagel, who is the founder of Pregnancy Plus, which became or is the largest pregnancy app in globally. And we're here to talk about, other than generally to talk to Amber, she's also got a new venture called 28X. Now, we were talking before the break around the sort of potential exploitation of women with false or misleading information that's being used to commercialize women or women's health issues. And I think that's a great segue into what Amber's up to at the moment. So Amber, why don't you give us a bit of background about what you've built?
Yes, after I exited my company to Philips, and I stayed quite a few years afterwards because we had a brilliant time at Philips. They've been great. I thought, let's take it easy, look after the kids, play some tennis, do some consultancy work. Yeah. And then I read a book, a Dutch book called Moral Ambition, and it's going to be published in the UK next year. And it basically said that the biggest waste of our generation is a waste of talent. So our cleverest minds are working to optimize TikTok feeds and Facebook algorithms, where we should be working on climate change and cancers and all these big topics. Now, I've got no illusion that I can solve any of those big topics. But I'm really good at women's health apps. I'm really good at engaging women in digital spaces and building fun environments. So I thought, where can I make the biggest difference? So if you look in the stores, there's no apps bigger than period apps, cycle trackers. Okay. So
you mean in general of all apps?
All the women's health apps or health space period trackers are top of the ranking. They're 10, 15 times bigger than pregnancy apps.
Wow. Okay.
So it's interesting because if you have a so pregnancy, we do, I don't know, 15 million downloads a year.
Yeah.
I think Flow's got 350 million users on the platform. If you do a baby app, that's 10 times as small again as a pregnancy app. So it's like, it's the drop off.
Well, because you get busier, right? I guess, right? When you get the baby, you're quite busy. So you probably don't have time to check the app.
They need the app the most, but they're just too busy. So yeah, you see 80, 90% drop off from Prexy app to a baby app. Right? So the audience becomes smaller. But period trackers are massive because people use those apps for decades. They just, in the old days, they have a calendar, a paper calendar, and now they want to record it digitally. So that is an impressive platform. I believe Flow and Clue, they have something like together 70, 80 million women a month on their platform. That's huge.
That's huge. And what's like the, do you know what the retention rate is? Because obviously, presumably women use them monthly, I would guess. But like, what's the churn on it? Do you know, or anything? Like,
I think, I would imagine they're quite, I don't sticky. Know, but I do know that 69% of the 18 to 24-year-olds, 69% use these period trackers.
Wow.
And the CAGR is 19% each year, so 19% more audience year on year.
Wow.
So worldwide, of course. So it's growing because more women have access to mobile phones, more women have access to these solutions.
Yeah. Wow.
So when it comes to that, I think there are some great apps out there. I think they're all dated a little bit because they've been going on for a very long time. And I think there's one big issue I have with it that is, like with lots of women's health solutions digitally, is that it's exploiting women in the sense that there is subscriptions, there's employer models, they're sharing data, and I think we can do better. So what about the 80%? That's always my question. What about the 11 or 12-year-old girl that just had her period? She can't go to the app store and download an app. So where is she going to get her information from?
Yeah.
What about after Roe versus Wade? Women are really worried about their data being exposed. I think in general, we should be worried about data. I always say everyone can see, and I don't mind cookies about what I buy on Amazon. If I buy I don't know, a garden hose, fine for everyone to know.
Yeah.
Retarget me with more garden hoses. but in the future, like AI, we'll do our pre-recruitment. Like big airlines in the Middle East, they already do AI recruitment for staff. So if they have a stewardess that they have a job position for, they will post online, and AI will do the first recruitment. So they get 2,000 applications, and AI will choose the first 100 people to go through, and then the human will do the next phase. So you can see whether we like that or not, in the next 10, 20 years for those jobs, I think AI will play a role. But AI is really good at data. Humans are really bad at big data.
Mm.
We have a lot of it, and we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
But AI is pretty good at big data. So if you don't have cookies flying around that you are looking to get pregnant, I wonder who's going to get the job, the woman who has cookies on getting pregnant or the one who isn't. And because AI is a black box, you can't really prove, you can't prove if they have that data or not. And these tools, they will be optimized for success. They will be. You will buy a subscription on a recruitment tool, and they will be optimized for the better outcomes. And who will get in the future the better health insurance? The person who looked at cervical cancer articles or the one who didn't? So I think when it comes to health, I'd be really worried where my data goes.
And what do you think is happening or potentially happening with, because I completely agree with you, and I didn't realize, I hadn't thought through the implications actually of that, but that the stuff around the hiring piece makes total sense. And I'm sure there's lots of other places where this could come into play. But what is your specific concern? Is it about the way that the current, you know, what do you want to call it, current crop, current leaders of these, if this app spaces handle that data?
Well, I think we all grown up in an area where we were taught that data equals money. So the more data we have, the more valuable we are. And that's why VCs back companies that harvest data, and they use it in various ways. So we did the other way around, because I thought, what if we say data is difficult, and it's difficult to be compliant, and security risks and everything. So what if we do not collect any data? Because I quite like to offer a new blueprint for healthcare solutions where we don't collect any data at all. So okay. What we do is we've got a whole new architecture where we basically go back to on-device AI, and we physically don't have any cloud servers at the back. So we don't pollute whatsoever, because it's very polluting, those cloud servers.
Okay.
But we did work out that if we give women options to donate their data. So we will get certain women, we will ask in the app that the AI on device can analyze, to donate their data for research. But it's their choice, and it's their decision, which is, so I'm all for collecting data, but it shouldn't be by default stored on a server that you don't know where that goes and then be sent to research. Why can't it go straight to an end user, like Cambridge Research? Why does it have to pass my server? So we created a new architecture where we don't have any backends. Okay. So we're super, super safe.
That's
super
good on the developer side, because some of those backend guys are expensive.
Exactly. And we don't want any cost, so we can make the app free. So if we scale to millions and hundreds of millions of users, we don't have any incremental costs because we have no backend. Okay. So that's how we can make this app for free, available to the world.
That's pretty unique, isn't it? I mean, pretty much most apps use back-end cloud stuff, right? I mean, that's a completely unique approach, isn't it?
I've not heard of it, and I once we're live, I'd like to post it online, and then everyone can see this as a blueprint apps.
We leapt into the execution there, so go back a couple of steps. So what's the vision for 28X? Like, obviously, women's health, yes, but that's a big area. So where are you starting? What's the focus? What do you hope the outcomes are going to be?
It is it's a portal to health. So we will provide basic cycle tracking for women in a very fun and creative way. Once you see the designs, I can't show it because it's radio. It's going to look amazing. And I think that's one thing. In the end, it's not about blood. It needs to be fun. It needs to be engaging. It needs to be fun to track this. And we've got a great platform, I think, and a great design to do that. But secondly, then there's a massive benefit for the health systems. I think their research shows that 43% of all women and girls have sought help from their GP for period symptoms.
Right.
And a lot of those women, the questions they ask, they could have.
What's crazy about that is that's even with all of the current period trackers, right?
Mm.
So it's 43% even with everybody out there.
I think the elective recovery waiting list have 700,000 women on it, and lots of them are on the wrong waiting list. So I think getting better menstrual health literacy early on, but you have to provide that in lots of different literacy levels, because not everyone's educated. And that's where I think the problem quite often start with those apps. They're designed for a very typical white woman, educated. And I think we need to think broader. So what about people with disabilities or the visually impaired and neurodiverse? What about the very young girls? Like, if you have menstrual education from a very young age, you prevent lots of issues later on in life. So it all starts with looking at the whole society and not only the women we can sell subscriptions to.
Yeah. What are some of the issues if you get poor or sort of incomplete menstrual advice at a young age? What are some of the risks for your future health?
Oh, there's many, but it already starts by work and school absence and dropping out of school and sports. So one in three women have a very heavy period. That means that they need to see a toilet every hour. So if you feel uncomfortable with that, lots of girls don't dare to talk about it and decide to stay home from school.
Right.
They drop out of sports, and that has implications for your health later on. But then there's also the symptoms of PCOS that are very clear quite often. You can see excessive hair growth, you can see it in the skin. And I think if these women are aware earlier on, there's much more to do when it comes to fertility and the issues that's quite often are found way too late. And then there's endometriosis, again, a very complex issue. But lots of women take 14 years to find out that they actually have that.
I did a show with a PCOS. We did a PCOS endometriosis show with a female health tech leader, and she said it often takes an average of 8 or 9 appointments to get a diagnosis, or 8 or 9 specific appointments or tests or basically interactions with the healthcare service over many, many years to get an endometriosis or PCOS diagnosis.
Oh, and that is a difficult word even to write or read. So how are you going to explain that to the entire population? That is the question. So what we try to do in the app, for example, is have different reading levels. So you can choose your own reading level without any judgment. But there's a reading level, the average reading level in the UK is, I believe, 9 years old. So we will have that reading level for very young children or the less educated. And then we have a very high reading level for very clinical women who like to read clinical content and everything in the middle. So that already gives you, but me personally, I like short sentences. I'm very dyslexic, so I like short sentences, simple words. Right. So I might choose a lower reading level because it's just easier to digest the information.
And how are you handling cultural differences around women's health? Because that was another thing that came out quite strongly in the last show I did with Buki Ayoade around specifically menopause, to be fair to her, but around cultural differences, not just in approaches and views on these topics, but actual differences in how menopause develops in different cultures, you know, different ethnicities.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So we have a few ways that we do it. So age appropriate and clinically sensitive is two big pillars for us. In the app, you during onboarding, but you can also change it later, we ask you if there's certain topics you just don't want to read about.
Okay.
So you can turn them off. So I don't know, you know those algorithms in social media, like Pinterest. I love Pinterest. I make my own Pinterest boards. But what happens is at some point, a friend of mine says, hey, have you seen, I don't know, that IKEA cabinet is quite nice. Yeah. So I find it on Pinterest. And then from that moment on, I only get IKEA cabinets.
You need to take it out of the algorithm.
Because the algorithm kind of constantly re-gives you back what you've asked for. So, and there's no way where you can say, I don't want to see this anymore. Entirely, you can report an ad, but you can't say in TikTok, just don't give me any Trump ads because of or whatever content on politics. I just don't want to see it for a week. You can't switch it off. They feed you what they want to feed. So we're turning it around. We say, if you don't want to see anything about sex or you don't want to read about blood because you find it, you want a different word for it, you can actually move those sliders. So you can change your own settings. If you just had a miscarriage, you don't want to see any articles on fertility.
No.
So you should be able to move the slider to fertility to off. So there's no content from that moment in the app that references any of those topics.
Wow. Okay.
So that it's giving you
like
the power.
Extremely sensitive. Yeah. You can adapt it to where you feel comfortable.
But again, if you are in it for a purpose of making money, you want people to digest as many articles as possible. We're going in from what does the user and these women actually want to see. And that's a whole different side. So she might miss out on some content and we might want to occasionally say, are you sure you don't want to read more about X, Y, or Z? But it's her choice in the end.
I think that's a great point to finish the second part of the show. So we're going to go for our second commercial break and then we'll be back for the last part of this week's show, this week's Health Tech Out, with Amber Fodagle, who is the founder of 28X and the founder of Pregnancy Plus, which is the largest pregnancy app. In the world. So we'll be right back for the final part of this week's show.
Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour, the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Amber Fodagle, who is the founder of 28X and the founder of Pregnancy Plus, the largest pregnancy app in the world. So go back to 28X. So where are you now with the business? Is it live? Is it available? Is it beta, alpha? Where are you with things?
We started 6 months ago, so it's very new.
Yeah.
So we have a clickable prototype ready, and the brand is there, and we have we're working on our partnerships and the medical board. So it will be another 6-9 months, I think, till it's live. But I will be posting a waiting list, so people can already pre-register. We need to make a lot of noise at some point to get people on the waiting list.
Okay, that would be cool
before launch.
Okay, nice. And like, what's the feedback that you have? Have you done any like user group testing and things like that? Like, what's generally the feedback? Because you've got a few kind of philosophies at play here around, you know, how to access the information, how to adapt the information to the right user groups, you know, not being shown ads, and, you know, different ways to write the articles, which I think is all fantastic. So have you, what's the feedback been so far from women that you've sort of interacted with about it?
I think there's been lots of great feedback comes from parents mainly.
Okay.
Because fathers that say, I want my daughter to have a safe app, and mothers. So I think there's a lot of need there. But we did some guerrilla testing in schools with young children. And because we also have a metaphor that we use for the cycle, which is a bit of a wider story. So we have a beautiful movie that we're creating that will be posted on YouTube Health for teachers to use in the classrooms. So we told the children about cycles in a new way. And they loved it. They all came after you do a class. They come up to you saying, where can we get this app? We would love to use
it. Oh, that's cool. What was the way you talked about the cycle? What was the, is it secret? I don't know.
Nothing is a secret, because if everyone wants to do a free app, go ahead. I'm funding this myself. it's philanthropic, this. But so if you look at all the pregnancy trackers, period trackers out there, whether it's Clue or Flow or Natural Cycles, they all have a circle with a date. Mm-hmm. And they have a red and a green traffic light system, like when your period is red, when your fertile is green.
Okay.
I think that's very technical. And I also think women are not binary. It's not red one day and green the next. Yeah. I think that's how teenage pregnancies happen. But it's also quite embarrassing. So if you're in public transport and you open a period tracker, and it says in big letters, you're ovulating today, and then the guy next to you kind of smirks. I mean, it's not great, is it?
Right.
Thought, how can we do this better? So we have a beautiful interface on the home screen, and you don't have to use it. You can swipe it away. But it will represent all your menstrual cycle in an image. So one of the things that we're developing is a butterfly.
Okay.
Where you can see if there's four dots in the wings, it's 4 days to your period. If it's three dots, it's 3 days. Okay. And if the wings glow red, you're on your period. And then they become green when you're ovulating or when you're fertile. But it's a gradual change with colors. So it's not like a traffic light system.
Okay.
And this creature is like almost like a Tamagotchi. It responds to you. If you feel you're sad, it will the wings will hang down. And if it's happy, it will flutter more. And you can speak to it, and it can add your menstrual data. And especially for the younger girls, it's such more. I think the cycle is difficult. You have difficult days and painful days, but it's also a beautiful process. And I think we need to give back something, a new narrative, a new story about this beautiful process in your body. So we try to do that with animated movies, just to build up the understanding a bit more. Well, in the end, people are storytellers. If you say there's a 0.8% chance that someone will stop you in a forest and try to rob you, nobody listens to that. But if you tell the Little Red Riding Hood with the wolf or whatever, it kind of
everyone
sticks.
Everyone remembers it forever.
So we need to give those girls something more positive, a beautiful story that they can relate to, but also when something is off, that they can then talk to their doctor or their parents.
Cool. So naming no names, obviously, but what's your view on whether women's health apps should be founded by women or men, or does it matter or does it not matter? Where do you end up on this debate?
It's a good question. I wonder what your vision is there. I think it shouldn't matter whether a man or a woman creates it. I think it's with what intention you have in the end. If I think it's great that two men from Belarus built the biggest period tracker worldwide, I think they've done really well. I think there's really good content in there. I'm less keen on their class action lawsuit for sharing data.
What's that? What have they done?
They've got a class action lawsuit in Canada for sharing data on women's sex lives to Facebook.
Oh, really?
I believe.
Wow. Okay.
I think it's never intentional, but being super careful, I think, is what's really needed in this space, especially what's going on in the US, and which will also be in more countries, of course, an issue.
With Roe versus Wade, you mean, in the US, is that what you mean?
Lots of women, they're deleting their period trackers because they're worried that their data can be used. And then they can get prosecuted and they can actually go to jail if they can see from your data that you might have had an abortion.
Wow.
So the government there can ask for the data.
Because they can subpoena it because it's a criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And that's, of course, not here, but there's many other countries in the world where I think data safety is incredibly important to protect women. So I'm not against it. I think Flo received recently over 200 million in funding from venture capitalists. That money needs to be, that money, and they already had 75 million, I believe.
Yeah.
That money needs to be earned back. And the same goes for Clue and Natural Cycles. Natural Cycles got 95 million. They all need to make that money back for investors. So left or right, whether it's data, subscriptions, employer models, that money needs to be earned back. And that's a lot of money that needs to be earned back.
Yeah.
So what we are trying to do is we may have sponsors in the future. I mean, I can't be affording this for the rest of my life to pay singly myself. And we will get some sort of Wikipedia model where there's voluntary contributions. There will be some sponsors in the app, large corporate organizations that for their ESG goals want to support this. But what we want to do is excessive profits that we make, we want to donate to a foundation. And that foundation should then reinvest all these profits back into education, back into research, back into free period products and tampons for girls. So I'm not against making money. I'm happily paying great salaries and some dividends. But when it comes to excessive wealth, excessive millions, I think that shouldn't go to a few individuals. I think that should go back to women's health because there's so much to do. So it's a whole different setup of this company. So we're also not structured for an exit. I don't want to sell the company because when I sell it, it then goes to a commercial entity.
Yeah,
which then will exploit women again.
Yeah.
So the idea is to keep it.
What's interesting, right? Like, I think all of that sounds just so inspiring. It really does. And it kind of triggers this thing around, where's this line? And we touched on it earlier. What's the line between raising awareness and exploitation? I.e., the more people that you could make an argument that the more people that use period tracking apps, the more women are aware of their cycles and they're healthier because they're more aware and there's fewer unwanted pregnancies, etc. A little bit like what we talked about earlier. But where's the line for you between more awareness is better and exploitation?
Do you mean, sorry, I'm struggling with the question. Do you mean if you are VC backed and you receive a lot of funds that you can go wide and therefore have more awareness? And
I think it was more general than that, to be honest with you, which is that a little bit like on the show that I did before, where it was sort of the NHS specialist was talking about how in one way it's social media is good because it raises awareness of these issues, but in another it's bad because there are clearly people that are using it to exploit women. So where is that line? Like, what's better? What's the least worst? You see what I mean? I was just more like inquiring about where you sort of stood on that issue.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think awareness is important. I mean, it all starts with education. Whatever you do, you need to educate yourself. So I think you can never have enough awareness. I just think it's time that the world sees a few new structures of companies that are set up for good. And I think we're lacking a little bit of those. So if I speak to a lot of companies, I speak also to VCs, and I say, can we not come up with a different structure? Like, you fund us and I'll pay you back 3-4x. But after that, I want to buy back the shares because I don't want to pay for the next 20 years all the profits back to a few individuals. I want to give that back to women's health. I would like to make ethical decisions on who are my sponsors. And I don't want to hit the targets that some of those, if you borrow a lot of money, you have to hit those targets. And then you make ethical concessions. You say, okay, I'll just take that partnership, even though I don't agree with it. So I think we need to show the world there's different ways of running these companies.
I agree. And I think something happened last week, which I read, which is not related to women's health. It was just health in general, is that 23andMe might go bankrupt. So did you see that? 23andMe might go under. And then
the data will be sold.
Exactly. The data is going to get sold as part of the administration process to who, how, like, how do you, and I don't, I didn't look into it massively, but it sounded like in the article that there isn't a piece of legislation that exists that would prevent the sale of that data as an asset of that business that got liquidated. Like, it's just an asset just because it's DNA data. There's no piece of legislation that exists that ring fences that. When I was like, whoa, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. But it sort of lines up with what you're talking about. Like, let's say Flow goes out of business. Well, obviously, it won't be for a while. They've got 200 million, but I'm assuming their burn rate's pretty punchy. I'm assuming they've got quite a few back end developers, unlike you. But what happens to all those that women's health data? Highly identifiable, highly personal, highly sensitive. Where does it go? It doesn't just disappear.
Yeah, it's a good point. And that's why you can never predict what's going to happen in the future or what government you're going to have. So again, with data, a lot of that, everyone can know my buying habits online. I'm all fine with that. But when it comes to health data, we need a different structure. We need a different model. And it's hard to find. I mean, if I would go back in time 6 months and I would have gone to a VC saying, give me 10 or 20 million and I'll build you the next biggest period app, they would have signed the next day.
Yeah.
Because I say, no, we're not going to collect data. We're going to do it a bit more ethical. Yeah. And we would like to donate future profits back to education and research. All of a sudden I say, not sure. Yeah. So it's an interesting play field. And I think that there will be companies that I say, you know what, we actually, or individuals, we'd like to support this. We'd like to leave a legacy because in the end, we're all benefiting if there's better health and better education.
Makes sense. I agree. I think this has been a fantastic conversation. Really opened my eyes to a few things. Even, you know, I'm a man, but I've done quite a few shows in and around the women's health space. But this has completely opened my eyes to a bunch of things that I'd never even considered before. So that's why I do the show. You know, if it's opened my eyes, I hope it's opened some other people's eyes too. So we've got 3 minutes left. Well, really, like 2 minutes because I have to finish a minute early for the outro. If you had to give anyone advice about starting your own company, what's kind of like the one piece of advice or one sort of motto or phrase that you keep going back to that's gotten you through all of the difficult times, of which I'm sure there has been many?
There's always three things. Think of the long term, because in the end, long term strategies will stay. So what do you want? And what do you want you to look back on in your life? Be proud of what you're building. Hire the best people. For our first company, I only had very few people, but they were incredible. So you can't have enough of great people, and then you only need a few.
Yeah.
And the last one is obsess over customers. Every day when I wake up, I think, what can I do to make this app better, to make it work for them? Because in the end, that's your client. So obsess over your customers. Those three things. And then learn to say no. There's so much FOMO that you think, oh, I should have an integration with Aura or with whatever AI tools. But the best solutions are often quite simple. So keep it simple and then build from there.
Brilliant. Well, that is a great moment to end on. Amber Fodagle, thank you so much for your time and for your insights. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. And thanks for everyone listening.
Yeah, all right. And thank you to everyone listening. And we'll be back again next week.
Thank you.